Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1137, Lyme Disease and Biological Warfare, Part 3. This is being recorded on June 27th of the year 2020. As the title of the program indicates, this is the third broadcast in a series dealing with Lyme disease and biological warfare. Although we will be dealing with Lyme disease per se in this program, we will also be taking something of a detour back into time, to coin a phrase, and we will be taking a look at what researcher Elena Cook terms spirochetal warfare. Now, in our first two programs, we took a look at Lyme disease as biological warfare, and we took a look at, among other things, a mysterious agent that appears to be involved with Lyme disease in addition to the spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi. That is the mysterious Swiss agent. In this program, we are going to be taking a look at Borrelia burgdorferi and spirochetes in general. We will conclude by taking a look at the possibility, again, the possibility that Borrelia burgdorferi may be involved in some aspect of the development of Alzheimer's disease. As we will see in our conclusion, Lyme disease can be what Ms. Elena Cook terms a great imitator. It can mimic or exhibit the same symptomatology as other diseases, and it can persist in the central nervous system for quite some time. But again, a fair amount of discussion in this program will be about spirochetal warfare, and in particular, we will be taking a look at a 1944 text by a fellow named Barclay Newman, a scientist and former malaria researcher for the U.S. Navy. He published a book in 1944 called Japan's Secret Weapon, talking about Unit 731 and biological warfare. And in that book, which was officially discredited or suppressed, he talks at some length about the pioneering work of Japanese biological warfare scientists on spirochetal warfare. And this has some implications for the present. We're going to begin by taking a look at a portion of an essay that we used in For the Record 585, which was recorded in early 2007. We have a couple of excerpts of this essay in the early part of our last program. It is called History of Lyme Disease as a Bioweapon, Lyme as a Biowarfare Issue. This by Elena Cook, E-L-E-M-A, Cook, C-O-O-K. In this paper, Ms. Cook writes as follows. The Borrelia genus of bacteria, which encompasses the Borrelia burgdorferi species group to which Lyme disease is attributed, was studied by the infamous World War II Japanese Biowar Unit 731, who carried out horrific experiments on prisoners in Manchuria, including dissection of live human beings. Unit 731 also worked on a number of other tick-borne pathogens. After the war, the butchers of Unit 731 were shielded from prosecution by the U.S. authorities, who wanted to keep their expertise for the Cold War. The U.S. government also protected and recruited German Nazi bioweaponeers under the aegis of the top-secret Operation Paperclip. Borrelia were known for their ability to adopt different forms under conditions of stress, such as exposure to antibiotics. Shedding their outer wall, which is the target of penicillin and related drugs, they could ward off attack and continue to exist in the body. Lyme disease is not usually fatal, and it is sometimes argued that with rapidly lethal agents like smallpox and plague available, an army would have no interest in it. However, what is important to understand here is that incapacitating or non-lethal bioweapons are a major part of biowarfare R&D and have been for decades. Military strategists understand that disabling an enemy's soldiers can sometimes cause more damage than killing them, as large amounts of resources are then tied up in caring for the casualties. An inefficient, incapacitating weapon dispersed over a civilian population could destroy a country's economy and infrastructure without firing a shot. People would either be too sick to work or too busy looking after those who were. And with that as something of a jumping off point, we are going to take a look at Alema Cook's work again. However, this is from an essay that she posted on August 20th of 2013. It is termed, or titled, I should say, Spirokeep Warfare, again by that very same researcher, Alema Cook. Now, in the excerpts that we will be reading from this, she is going back again in time to 1944 and accessing information from a very important book by Barclay, B-A-R-C-L-A-Y, Newman, capital N-E-W-M-A-N. He was a leading scientist and former U.S. Navy malaria specialist, and in 1944 he published a book called Japan's Secret Weapon, about Japanese biological warfare research. And there were 28 pages devoted to spirochetal warfare. And one of the things that is important to note here is that the Japanese were the leaders in the world at that time in spirochetal warfare, and they had develop techniques for not only growing spirochetes, but for manifesting them as biological warfare agents in their L form and in tiny nodules. And they were able to not only develop diseases like slime fever, but others as well. And we are going to take a look at the Japanese research and consider the implications for the possible development of Borrelia burgdorferi as a biological warfare weapon. Note that one of the spirochete-caused diseases is something called relapsing fever, which is a major cause of illness and fatality in Africa, or was at that time. It was also something that was studied at great length by Rudolf Geige. He was Willy Burgdorfer's mentor, and also from the J.R. Geige family, or the family that founded J.R. Geige, part of the World War II Swiss component of IG Farben. In the first program in this series, we took a look at circumstantial evidence that indicates the distinct possibility that Rudolf Geige was A, part of the massive and vitally, centrally important IG Farben espionage establishment, and that he may, again may, have been a recruiter for Project Paperclip, in that he helped to place many scientists into institutions involved with U.S. biological warfare research, one of those being Willy Burgdorfer. Now, we are going to, again, plunge into some excerpts of Spirochete Warfare by Alema Cook, published on August 20th of the year 2013. And Ms. Cook begins here with the subject of Borrelia. Borrelia, the microbes which cause Lyme disease, are a subtype of the wider biological classification of spirochetes. Now, it has become apparent that the spirochetes were weaponized over 75 years ago. That knowledge comes to us from a book published in 1944. The title of the book is Japan's Secret Weapon, by Barclay Newman, a leading science writer of the time, as well as former U.S. Navy malaria scientist. For decades, the public health agencies of the U.S. and other NATO countries have denied the existence of virulent, cell wall-deficient forms of spirochetes. The lack of the cell wall renders microbes resistant to penicillin and related antibiotics, as these work precisely by disrupting the formation of new cell walls during bacterial replication. The minute size and pleomorphic nature of these forms, in contrast to the striking spiral shape of a typical spirochete as featured in modern microbiology textbooks, made these microbes appear invisible, unquote. Above all, to those who did not wish or did not wish others to see them. This World War II-era book helps to confirm what some investigating the history of Lyme disease have long suspected, that the official denial of the devastating pathogenic nature of the granule and other L forms of Lyme-causing Borrelia is related to their biological warfare significance. To put it bluntly, Newman's book provides cogent, circumstantial evidence that many cell wall-deficient forms of Borrelia are in fact weaponized spirochetes, nurtured, cultured, and optimized for aerosol delivery. The following essay is based on the information in Chapter 4 of Newman's book. The title of the chapter is simply Spirochete Warfare. For many decades, it was assumed that the horrors of the Second World War did not include the use of biological weapons. Finally, in the 1980s, thanks to the diligent efforts of historians and investigative journalists, the barbaric crimes of the Japanese Unit 731 were revealed to the general public. Unit 731 and related units practiced mass medical experimentation, including the cutting open of living human beings, who endured grotesque surgical operations without anesthetic. Often, the purpose was to observe directly the hemorrhaging and other changes in the organs of the victim, man, woman, or child, as he or she died in agony from a deliberately induced infectious disease. As well as human experimentation, the Japanese scientists launched attacks with plague and other weapons of mass destruction, killing many thousands of Chinese and other victims. The true death toll of these atrocities is not yet known outside of classified circles. Though the U.S. government has long denied it, not only were they fully aware of the Japanese and Nazi biowarfare programs, but also, incredibly, after the war, they protected the architects of these programs of death from prosecution as war criminals. This was in order to recruit them for the American biological weapons program against the Soviet bloc, which they duly did. We now know, for example, that the U.S. allowed leading Nazi bioweaponeer Eric Traub to play a major role in setting up research at their biowarfare lab on Plum Island, a stone's throw away from Lyme, Connecticut, where the first recorded outbreak of Lyme disease in America occurred in the 1970s. Traub's germ warfare knowledge was considered so important that, his Nazi past notwithstanding, he was invited to take charge of scientific research on the island in the 1950s. Like Traub, Japanese biowarfare men were similarly greeted with open arms, their wartime atrocities hushed up. In return for their cooperation, the U.S. allowed these monsters to occupy some of the most prestigious and influential posts in Japanese medicine till their retirement decades later. During the war, Barclay Newman, leading science writer and former malariologist with the U.S. Navy, became aware that the Japanese were building up a program of deadly biological weaponry. Desperate to warn his countrymen of what he believed was an impending Armageddon, he wrote a book called Japan's Secret Weapon. At the time, again that was 1944, the American military authorities wanted to ban his book, but later decided that to do so would call too much attention to the very issues they considered it necessary to cover up. Instead, they resorted to arranging a smear campaign against the author and unfavorable reviews dismissing Newman's revelations as alarmist fantasy were published in the press. Today, thanks to the efforts of reading historians, we now know that Newman's fears regarding a Japanese biological warfare program of mass destruction were soundly based and, indeed, one of the most authoritative works on the history of BioWarfare Unit 731 relies on information found in Newman's book. Japan's Secret Weapon contains no less than 28 pages on one aspect of the Japanese bioweapon program, spirochete warfare. Newman begins his chapter of the same name by lamenting the widespread disbelief in his era of the true devastating potential of germ warfare. He then alleges that 2 to 3 years before Pearl Harbor, quote, Nazi and Japanese scientists cooperated in warfare against or with spirochetes in Hawaii. And again, he's talking about Japanese and Nazi cooperation in biological warfare against Hawaii 2 to 3 years before Pearl Harbor. We have in past discussion spoke about collaboration between the Third Reich and Japanese espionage on Hawaii with regard to Pearl Harbor before the outbreak of hostilities on December 7th of 1941. And again, returning to Elena Cook's Spirochete Warfare and this book, Japan's Secret Weapon by Barclay Newman. Nazi and Japanese scientists cooperated in warfare against or with spirochetes in Hawaii. What he is referring to is an exceptionally virulent outbreak of the spirochetal disease leptospirosis, that's L-E-P-T-O-S-P-I-R-O-S-I-S, also known as Weil's disease, W-E-I-L, and known at the time in Germany as slime fever, unquote. With official reports of 44% mortality from the outbreak, Newman states, consult the authorities, and you will find out that very definitely so high a mortality is attained only by Japanese strains of spirochetes of slime fever. In his characteristic tongue-in-cheek style, Newman goes on to say the following. Suppose you consult a spirochete specialist in his laboratory at an institute devoted to research on tropical diseases. This specialist is busy, of course, but not so busy as he ought to be or as he will be later. Quote, it is difficult even for an expert technician to catch and recognize a spirochete, unquote, the specialist informs you. So here are some pictures from the gallery of the world's worst rogues. Newman goes on to describe a picture of a typical syphilis spirochete in the manual offered by the hypothetical spirochetologist to the reader and then says, bacterium, you ask? No, not according to the Japanese, who know the most about spirochetes. They are like bacteria in being low forms of plant life, that is, fungi. The Japanese claim that spirochetes are closely related to bacteria, but are not bacteria, among which spiral forms are found. Like bacteria, spirochetes reproduce by splitting across the middle. But the Japanese think that a spirochete can also break itself into many tiny granules, each as small as the invisible molecule of a virus, and each capable of recreating a new spirochete. Bacteria do not seem to multiply in this odd way. The Japanese say that there is no drug effective against this spirochete. Now, this was in 1944, but again, note this. The Japanese think that a spirochete can also break itself into many tiny granules, each as small as the invisible molecule of the virus. That was in 1944, and each capable of recreating a new spirochete. Later on in our program, we are going to take a look at a mishap that Willy Burgdorfer had in his laboratory. Some urine from a Lyme-infected rabbit splashed into his eye, and he then began to manifest symptoms that he felt were Lyme disease. This was not obviously from a tick bite, and I am wondering if some of these spirochete manuals from Borrelia burgdorferi may have been in that rabbit urine that splashed into Lily's eye and gave him the symptoms that he interpreted as coming from Lyme disease. In the book Bitten by Chris Newby that we looked at in our first two programs in this series, Vili was in his old age suffering from Parkinson's disease, and Chris Newby at one point asked him if he thought his Parkinson's may have resulted from Lyme disease, and he said, quote, "Ask the doctors." As we will see later in our program, Lyme disease can, according to Willy Burgdorfer, linger, or the organisms can linger and lay in a dormant state in the nervous system for many years and then manifest, and it appears that Lyme disease can imitate many things, including some of the symptoms of Alzheimer's. More about that later. And again, returning to Japan's secret weapon and the spirochete warfare chapter that Elena Cook has excerpted here. And returning to the imaginary spirochetologist that Barclay Newman presents, the imaginary spirochetologist goes on to explain that much of the research on spirochetes current at that time, and even the manuals in use by U.S. forces and the Public Health Service, are based on Japanese findings. In Newman's scenario, the reader goes on to examine pictures of syphilis, Borrelia, and other spirochetes in the U.S. military manual, all originating from Japanese drawings. You find out that Inaba, INABA, and Ito, ITO, were the great investigators of the spirochetes of slime fever. And again, there was Barclay Newman felt was a suspicious outbreak of that 2 to 3 years before Pearl Harbor in Hawaii, the result of combined Nazi and Japanese biological warfare. Beginning again here, you find out that Inaba and Ito were the great investigators of the spirochetes of slime fever. When you peer closely at the dainty Japanese pictures of the spirochete, you perceive that although at first sight it appears to be a chain of bright knots, it is really a slender thread whose spiraling gives the impression of beading. The thread is curved or hooked at one or both ends. The living spiral propels itself by rotary motion of the hook, as the Japanese discovered. Newman then describes how the work, Newman then describes how the work of Hideo Noguchi, N-O-G-U-C-H-I, acclaimed worldwide for his discovery of the syphilis spirochete as the cause of general paresis in 1913, was continued in Japanese labs. Japanese technicians took a hint from Noguchi and forced the spirochete to multiply on special jellies. The Japanese have reported that you can increase the virulence or killing power of these spirals by growing them in flesh and blood of guinea pigs or humans. And again, I wonder if perhaps some of that was done in connection with U.S. biological warfare research vis-a-vis Lyme disease. Continuing, it is useful to remember at this point that the difficulty in culturing spirochetes using normal clinical methods was not just a pitfall of World War II-era technology. The resistance of many spirochetes, including Borrelia, to culture in vitro remains a problem for lab scientists even today. In Japan, vaccines for prophylaxis have long been in use, but non-Japanese workers cannot make such vaccines. None but the Japanese seems to know how to use spirochete vaccines to prevent the spread of an epidemic. Newman goes on to discuss the Japanese discoveries of spirochetal agents of Nanukayami, or seven-day fever, and Akiyami, or autumn fever. And then, referring to one of the original discoverers of the causative agent of leptospirosis, or slime fever, states, quote, Imaba has reported that the Japanese know how to get virus-like, quite invisible particles or spirochete fragments from special cultures of spirochetes of infectious jaundice. The Japanese say that such infinitesimals can be used to infect animals and men by spraying droplets containing these spirochete-creating bits into the air, or spreading them through water, or scattering them in mud or damp soil. And again, I wonder if that might have had something to do with how Willy Bergdorfer contracted what he felt was Lyme from having urine from a Lyme-infected rabbit splash into his eyes. Continuing, Newman then discusses the prevalence of leptospirosis worldwide, and his imaginary spirochete expert notes, quote, immediately before the Japanese invasions of China, Indochina, the Dutch East Indies, and the Malay states, and shortly before the Japanese invasions of India and the Japanese strokes at Australia, the very first outbreaks of slime fever were reported from every one of these areas. After an enigmatic discussion about American and British outbreaks of leptospirosis, or slime fever, and the tick-borne disease tularemia in the U.S., the latter Newman scientist describes as having somehow gotten in accidentally from Japan, the reader in the hypothetical discussion asks about antibiotics. And then skipping down, more about spirochetes and Japanese biological warfare. They, the Japanese, find spirochetes especially fascinating, and they never give up. In 1940, Masao Mujimori, M-U-J-I-M-O-R-I, reported new successes in transmitting syphilis spirochetes from cultures grown for many years in the laboratories of Tokyo Imperial University. Doubtless, the very cultures started in a small way by Noguchi. Fujimori was testing out the effects of spreading two different parasites into the same guinea pig at the same time. The Japanese discovered that one parasite promotes the lethal action of the other. He demonstrated that diphtheria bacilli are more virulent when used along with syphilis. This basically appears to be cross-vectoring or co-vectoring. Sometimes the Japanese think up the damnedest experiments, such as the transmission of syphilis by spraying the spirochetes into the air or into the eyes of animals or volunteers. Infection is thus accomplished. Japanese technicians have been not only the outstandingly successful cultivators of spirochetes and many other very deadly germs, but also the sole successful mass producers of the most dangerous and horrible microbes. Some of the apparently fantastic claims of new methods of transmission by Japanese specialists have been investigated and their truth established in American laboratories years after the claims were first made. Therefore, if you want to speculate further about the possibilities of spirochete warfare, you can be sure that the Japanese know how to spread any spirochete disease, slime fever, syphilis, yaws, sudoku, relapsing fever, by spraying droplets laden with specially cultured spirochetes. So they do not have to drop infected fleas, rats, or even leopards from planes, as suggested by popular writers. Relapsing fever is caused by the Borrelia genus of bacteria and is generally transmitted to man either by lice or by the bite of a tick. It is worth noting, too, that recent investigations into the genetic makeup of Lyme Borrelia have found some strains apparently more closely related to relapsing fever Borrelia than to Borrelia burgdorferi, long considered the only Borrelia capable of causing Lyme disease. One more time from Elena Cook's paper. Relapsing fever is caused by the Borrelia genus of bacteria and is generally transmitted to man either by lice or by the bite of a tick. It is worth noting, too, that recent investigations into the genetic makeup of Lyme Borrelia have found some strains apparently more closely related to relapsing fever Borrelia than to Borrelia burgdorferi, long considered the only Borrelia capable of causing Lyme disease. And more about relapsing fever. And the discussion here is a hypothetical dialogue with someone inquiring about relapsing fever. Killing hundreds of thousands, possibly millions? Where? In Africa today, where it, relapsing fever, is spread among tens of millions by ticks, lice, and bedbugs. The spirochete of relapsing fever is almost as important a killer as malaria and trypanosomiasis, or sleeping sickness. The spirochete virulence varies widely. Only a small percent may succumb, but in a few epidemics, the mortality has attained 75%. In West Africa, in a recent epidemic extending through several years, probably 10% of the entire population was killed off by spirochetes running wild from Morocco and Algiers, down the Niger to Senegal and the French Sudan, southward to the Gold Coast and Nigeria. Perhaps a million natives died in this one epidemic. And we're going to turn once again to the book Bitten, by Chris Newby, subtitled The Secret History of Lyme Disease and Biological Weapons. And one of the things that I want to note here is the research done by Willy Burgdorfer's mentor, Rudolf Geige, an individual who may have been, part of the IG Farben espionage establishment, and who may have been a recruiter for Project Paperclip. Again, those are hypothetical, but I think there is reasonable evidence for speculating about that. We looked at that in the first program in this series. From Bitten, about Rudolf Geige and relapsing fever. Vili peered into the sand that Geige was holding and saw nothing until Geige shook the dish. Suddenly, the sand crawled to life with soft bobby ticks. They looked like tiny, shriveled golden raisins with spidery black legs. Geige explained that in East Africa, these ticks bury themselves under the dirt floors of huts, patiently waiting for a blood meal. They spring to life when the scent organs in the tips of their front legs detect carbon dioxide from a nearby farm animal or human. Swiftly crawling onto a sleeping victim, they sink their sawtooth mouthparts into a vein and suck in warm blood for a few minutes before dropping off. During the blood meal, the tick can transmit the two potentially deadly diseases that Geige was studying: relapsing fever and African swine fever. From Africa, Geige airmailed Willie the ticks he had collected from small villages. He was trying to find the locations of relapsing fever outbreaks. Within 24 hours, Willie would dissect these ticks under a microscope and then telegraph the results to Geige. So again, hypothetically, I wonder if this might, the study of the spirochetal caused disease, African relapsing fever, might have in some way evolved over the decades into some of the biological warfare research that resulted in Lyme disease. And again, as Elena Cook has noted, the Some variants of the Borrelia-Burgdorferi theory appear to be closer to the spirochete that produces African relapsing fever. Now, I mentioned that Willi Burgdorfer, at one point during his biological warfare research, had some urine from a Lyme-infected rabbit splashed into his eyes, and he then developed what he felt was Lyme disease. And Chris Newby asks him if perhaps his Parkinson's disease had resulted from Lyme disease, and he sort of said, well, ask the doctors. Of the Lyme-infected rabbit urine that was splashed into Willi's eyes. Now, bearing in mind one of the things that was discussed in the book Japan's Secret Weapon by Barclay Newman and was discussed by Elena Cook, and that is the use of, by the alleged use by the Japanese of tiny spirochetal elements or nodules or particles or granules, which they found could be sprayed around into the eyes of volunteers and would cause disease. I wonder if some of those spirochete particles or granules may have been involved in what we're about to read about. And again, from Bitten by Chris Newby. During the first quarter of 1983, Willi was busier than ever with his Lyme research and fielding questions from scientists around the world. One Sunday in March, he went to the lab to clean the cages of his test rabbits. The rabbits had been inoculated with cultured spirochetes, and now ticks were being allowed to feed on the animals. To prevent the ticks from escaping, the rabbits' wire cages had been mounted over large porcelain trays filled with water. These trays had to be cleaned daily with boiling water, but because it was his lab technician's day off, Willi had to do it. While he was rinsing off one of the trays in the sink, Lyme-infected rabbit urine splashed into his eyes. A few weeks later, on April 13th, he noticed 5 Lyme's bullseye rashes under his armpit and on his torso. The family physician diagnosed the rashes as an initial reaction to a Lyme disease infection after a test for fungi came back negative. The lab was unable to isolate an infectious organism from Willie's blood or from a skin biopsy. Willi took a tetracycline antibiotic for 20 days before the rash disappeared. He sent a letter to Alan Steer at Yale asking for treatment advice. Always the meticulous scientist, he included a detailed sketch of his rashes, which looked very similar to those on his infected rabbits. When his Lyme disease test came back negative, Willie's co-workers were divided on whether he truly had Lyme disease. Co-discoverer Alan Barber, who had been trained as a physician, thought the rashes looked like a ringworm fungal infection. Willi insisted it was Lyme disease, explaining that the Lyme antibody test was negative only because his early dose of antibiotics may have halted the immune system reaction that the test measured. Quote, "The lesions resembled the initial reaction reported for Lyme disease," he wrote, "even though serological evaluation and attempts to isolate from blood or skin biopsy the causative agent, there appears to be no doubt about the diagnosis. Past experience has shown that patients with initial Lyme disease manifestations or lesions do not convert serologically when treated early with antibiotics." And so, again, he felt that he had Lyme disease, and I wonder if some of the research that was done by the Japanese about spirochetes, where tiny granules of spirochetes, little portions of them, could be sprayed via aerosol and cause infection. And one of the things that was specifically spoken about by Elena Cook was the spraying of those spirochete granules into the eyes of victims or volunteers, which then produced spirochetal pathology, spirochetal caused pathology, and I wonder if that may have happened with Willie. And we're going to look next at a hypothetical element here. There on page 203 from Bitten, there is this quote from the Willie Burgdorfer, "The brain involvement in Lyme disease," unquote. "It is now clear that Borrelia burgdorferi can persist within the nervous system for years, causing progressive illness, and increasing evidence suggests also that the spirochete can remain latent there for years before producing clinical symptoms." One more time. "It is now clear that Borrelia burgdorferi can persist within the nervous system for years, causing progressive illness, and increasing evidence suggests also that the spirochete can remain latent there for years before producing clinical symptoms." And one of the things that I wonder about here is the following. And returning, we're going to come back to the essay about spirochete warfare by Elena Cook, but returning briefly to Ms. Cook's discussion of from her her paper, "History of Lyme Disease as a Bioweapon, Lyme is a Biowarfare Issue," we read, "Lyme's ability to evade detection on routine medical tests, its myriad presentations which can baffle doctors by mimicking 100 different diseases, its amazing abilities to evade the immune system and antibiotic treatment would make it an attractive choice to bioweaponeers looking for an incapacitating agent. Lyme's abilities as the great imitator," unquote, might mean that an attack could be misinterpreted as simply a rise in the incidence of different naturally occurring diseases such as autism, MS, lupus, and chronic fatigue syndrome, or ME. Borrelia's inherent ability to swap outer surface proteins, beginning again, Borrelia's inherent ability to swap outer surface proteins, which may also vary widely from strain to strain, would make the production of an effective vaccine extremely difficult. A vaccine developed for the public by the Steer Camp in collaboration with GlaxoSmithKline was pulled from the market a few years ago amid class action lawsuits. Finally, the delay before the appearance of the most incapacitating symptoms would allow plenty of time for an attacker to move away from the scene, as well as preventing people in a contaminated zone from realizing that they had been infected and seeking treatment. Often, in the early period, there is no rash, only vague, flu-like, or other non-specific symptoms which might be dismissed by general practitioners or ignored by the patient. And again, bearing in mind about what Willie said about Lyme disease being able to remain dormant in the nervous system and then that for a period of years, again, reading from Bitten, "It is now clear that Borrelia burgdorferi can persist within the nervous system for years, causing progressive illness, and increasing evidence suggests also that the spirochete can remain latent there for years before producing clinical symptoms." And we're going to look at some of the other possible outgrowths of Lyme disease here. Returning to spirochete warfare by Elena Cook. "Lyme disease, like other spirochetal disease," beginning again, "Lyme disease, like that other spirochetal disease, syphilis, is known as a great imitator," unquote. "It is believed to be able to mimic dozens of conditions, including amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, chronic fatigue syndrome or ME, attention deficit disorder, multiple sclerosis, autism, rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and many more. Recent evidence has even linked it with the devastating plaque of Alzheimer's. And that is interesting and terrifying. What we're going to do is to take a look at a couple of papers dealing with Alzheimer's and the possibility of Lyme disease having something to do with the development of the Lyme disease plaque. This first paper, and I'm only going to excerpt some parts of it. This is extremely technical and very dense. This is by A.B. McDonald in Medical Hypotheses 2006-2007, and the URL for this, its title is Plaques of Alzheimer's Disease Originate from Cysts of Borrelia burgdorferi, the Lyme Disease Spirochete, unquote, again by A.B. McDonald. And the URL for this particular ailment, for this particular article will be in the written description for the record 137. Now again, I'm only going to excerpt this. This is extremely dense. Here is hypothesized a truly revolutionary notion that rounded cystic forms of Borrelia burgdorferi are the root cause of the rounded structures called plaques in the Alzheimer brain. Rounded plaques in high density in brain tissue are emblematic of Alzheimer's disease or AD. Plaques may be conceptualized as rounded, pockmark-like areas of brain tissue injury. In this century, in brain tissue of Alzheimer's disease, plaques are amyloid plaques, according to the most up-to-date textbooks. Then skipping down. Furthermore, there is plaque diversity, unquote, in Alzheimer's. Small, medium, and large plaques parallel variable cystic diameters for Borrelia burgdorferi, the organism that causes Lyme disease. And skipping down again. In the Anatomy is Destiny model, cysts of Borrelia are always round. Why then not accept roundness as a fundamental structure determines function, unquote, argument for the answer to the mystery of why Alzheimer's plaques are always round? And again, that is the URL for this will be in the written description for the record 1137. Now the next, and also very technical and very dense, this is by McClossy, M-I-K-L-O-S-S-Y et al. From the Neurobiological Aging of February 27th of 2006. And the title of this is Beta Amyloid Deposition and Alzheimer's Type Changes Induced by Borrelia Spirochetes. And the abstract here reads, the pathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease consist of B amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in affected brain areas. The processes which drive this host reaction are unknown. To determine whether an analogous host reaction to that occurring in Alzheimer's disease could be induced by infectious agents, we exposed mammalian glial and neuronal cells in vitro to Borrelia burgdorferi spirochetes and to the inflammatory bacterial lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. Morphological changes analogous to the amyloid deposits of Alzheimer's disease brain were observed following 2 to 8 weeks of exposure to the spirochetes. increased levels of B-amyloid precursor protein, or ABPP, and hyperphosphorylated tau, TAU, were also detected by Western blots of extracts of cultured cells that had been treated with spirochetes, or LPS. These observations indicate that, by exposure to bacteria or to their toxic products, host responses similar in nature to those observed in Alzheimer's disease may be induced. I'm going to read this again. I know this is, even by my admittedly pedantic standards, this is incredibly pedantic, but the implications here, if, and again, if with a capital I and a capital F, Borrelia burgdorferi, perhaps with some other co-vector here, if they can produce Alzheimer's disease or are involved with it, well, the implications are terrifying. And again, with Vili's insight that Borrelia burgdorferi can remain dormant in the nervous system for years and then produce pathology, again, from McClossy et al. From Neurobiological Aging from February 27th of 2006, beta-amyloid deposition and Alzheimer's type changes induced by Borrelia spirochetes. The pathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease, or AD, consist of B-amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles in affected brain areas. The processes which drive this host reaction are unknown. To determine whether an analogous host reaction to that occurring in Alzheimer's disease could be induced by infectious agents, we exposed mammalian glial and neuronal cells in vitro to Borrelia burgdorferi spirochetes, parenthetically that is the spirochete that produces Alzheimer's, and to the inflammatory bacterial lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. Morphological changes analogous to the amyloid deposits of Alzheimer's disease brain were observed following 2 to 8 weeks of exposure to the Borrelia burgdorferi spirochetes. Increased levels of B-amyloid precursor protein, ABPP, and hyperphosphorylated tau were also detected by Western blots of extracts of cultured cells that had been treated with spirochetes or LPS. These observations indicate that by exposure to bacteria or to their toxic products, host responses similar in nature to those observed in Alzheimer's disease may be induced. So again, I'm certainly not presenting this as conclusive, and I will have this in the end and the other McDonald essay in or paper in the written description for the record 1137 with their URLs. And I'm sure that I have butchered many of the pronunciations herein, and I apologize for that. But again, the implications or possible implications, I have wondered about Alzheimer's disease, and if in fact Lyme disease, spirochete Borrelia burgdorferi plays a role or can play a role in the development of Alzheimer's. Well, the implications are absolutely spectacular. So we are presenting that here. Now, we began by reading some excerpts from Elena Cook's essay about biological warfare, History of Lyme Disease as a Bioweapon, Lyme as a Biowarfare Issue by Elena Cook. We've read that into the record in For the Record 585. Also in For the Record 480, we went into Eric Traub and his work vis-a-vis Plum Island and Project Paperclip. I would note that in the prior essay by Elena Cook, again, History of Lyme Disease as a Bioweapon, the backgrounds of many of the other Lyme disease researchers with regard to biological warfare or related disciplines are discussed at some length. After talking about Borrelia burgdorferi and how it can shed its protein, it can shed its cell wall under conditions of duress, for example, under attack from antibiotics, and how this can not only make it difficult to spot, but very resistant to treatment. We went into the essay by Elena Cook, Spirochete Warfare, from August 20th of 2013, relying at great length on a 1944 book called Japan's Secret Weapon by Barclay Newman. We then recap some aspects of Lyme disease and biological warfare. We spoke from the Elena Cook and Barclay Newman sources about African relapsing fever and the similarity between the spirochete that produces that and some of the variations of Borrelia burgdorferi. We took a look too at in the Barclay Newman / Elena Cook recap of that material at the Japanese discovery that spirochetal granules, little tiny portions of spirochetes, could be aerosolized and could be sprayed to produce disease, including into the eyes of victims or volunteers. We took a look at how Vivi Bergdorfer, while cleaning the trays of Lyme-infected rabbits, had some rabbit urine from a Lyme-infected rabbit splashed into his eyes, and he then developed what he felt was Lyme disease. And we concluded with that hypothetical look at Lyme disease as the great imitator, unquote, and some unnerving papers, again, not conclusive, but certainly tantalizing and, again, unnerving, about the possibility, again, possibility with a capital P, of a connection between Lyme disease and Alzheimer's disease. This concludes For the Record program number 1137, Lyme Disease and Biological Warfare, Part 3. This is being recorded on June 27th of the year 2020. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.